Dubry Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is a chilly but bright February 13th, 2020. The first matter on our case for oral argument is the matter of Andrea Tallman versus Albert Brandmeier. Sorry. Counsel, I'm sure you're familiar with our procedures, but it's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. You will each have 15 minutes. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal, and the timing will be indicated by the lighting at the podium. You may raise or lower the podium to meet your needs. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court.
Excuse me. Out down a game.
There we go. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Fling. I represent the appellant, Andrea Tallman. This matter is before you today on appeal from a decision of Judge Lindberg in the Anoka County District Court. There are essentially two issues that we're dealing with today. Number one is the statute of limitations question and as to whether or not the contract claim made by the appellant is time barred. And then the second as to whether, if it's not time barred, is there an enforceable agreement in place? The facts of the case are essentially this. Appellant, respondent, and respondents.
Mr. Flake, I'm going to move you along because we know the facts pretty well, I
Very
think.
Good.
So with respect to the statute of limitations issue, you have argued in your blue brief that there's a distinction between the claim concerning the quitclaim deed and your claim for damages.
Yes, Your Honor.
You know what? I'm just going to stop. I don't know what is happening in the courtroom right now. No, I know. I'm not blaming anybody.
I'll stop the timer, but we're getting a lot of feedback. And I'm not sure why. So.
Right, and I don't know. Is there a way to make sure we are recording without broadcasting what we say?
I'm afraid if I turn it off, then we're going to.
All right, maybe we should take a. Should we turn down our speakers?
No, they're not too loud. That's not the problem.
I apologize.
Appreciate that my time is not expiring.
If you want to try to deal with this, we'll just take a quick.
No problem.
We're being compelled by what you're thinking in anticipation.
I know what thinking out loud is. I'm not used to hearing myself speak and then hearing myself speak out loud.
It's never happened before.
No. While we're in our little break, I'll note that we have some special guests in the courtroom today. Some members of a St. Paul-based Boy Scout troop. Welcome. This hopefully is going to give you a good idea of what happens in our court. You will hear some arguments on two sides of a case and lots of questions, and hopefully it'll be something you learn from. I think we're better now. All right, let's restart the time. We don't often get do-overs in life, but right now we have one.
Very good.
All right, you may proceed.
Your Honor, I believe you had a question, let me rephrase.
I think I wasn't quite.
Maybe not.
I was in the middle of the question.
Okay.
So I think I was asking about, you've made a distinction in your blue brief between a claim for specific performance of the quitclaim deed and on the other hand, damages.
Correct.
In the form of, I think, your share of the proceeds of the sale. But in your complaint, I'm looking in your complaint and I'm looking for that claim, the claim for breach of contract with a damages remedy. Is it there?
It isn't actually in the complaint, and the reason for that, Your Honor, is at the time that the complaint was served and filed, there hadn't been any kind of a sale. There wasn't any issue there with respect to distribution of proceeds. That essentially rose during the course of the case when the property was sold under a purchase agreement. Title couldn't be transferred because of the lis pendens that was existing against the property, and then what the parties did was an escrow agreement in exchange for a release of the lis pendens. That was then done, and I believe that was in October of 2018 before the trial of the case.
Was there ever an amended or supplemental complaint?
There was never any kind of an amended complaint. It's our position that essentially that it's the law of the case, and also the rules of civil procedure do provide for essentially amendment of the complaint according to the evidence that's presented and allowed at the trial. And in this case...
So by your complaint, aren't you acknowledging that the breach occurred before the sale went through and the claim for damages in the form of 50% of the sales proceeds, that the damage aspect of that claim ripened?
Are we claiming that the damages occurred prior to the sale?
Well, you brought your lawsuit for breach of contract before the sale occurred.
Correct.
So that seems to me reflects the understanding by your client that there had been a breach before the sale of the property to a third party.
Well, there'd been a breach in the sense that there had been no conveyance of the 50% interest in the property.
And didn't that breach occur at the time the agreement was in force? I mean, way back
at the time,
in September
29th, 2000, that's the position that the district court took, that interjecting the term that the requirement for performance was immediate at the time of closing, but the agreement itself didn't provide for that. In essence, it could have been done at any time after that.
Well, I'm reading the agreement. It says, upon the signing of the closing documents dated this September 29th, 2000, Andrea Tallman will be quitclaimed into title. Doesn't upon suggest a temporal requirement? Upon an act is when the act occurs, isn't it?
I would suggest to the court that what it means is upon that occurring, then at any time thereafter, and it never occurred. And as such, the statute of limitations would not have accrued at that time.
But, just to clarify, though, Mr. Fling, isn't it true, it's undisputed factually, that the closing documents were indeed signed, in fact, that day?
Yes, Your Honor.
So then I thought I just heard you say then the obligation did begin upon the signing of the closing documents. If the closing documents began that day, the obligation to quit claim her share began on that day.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that it really would, the obligation would occur at any time after demand. In other words, the obligation existed, but it wasn't required by the agreement that it happen on that day.
Well, from a statute of limitation standpoint, though, I mean, isn't that the critical beginning day there? Nevertheless, that's why the court looked at that, is that, yeah, she could have reminded him, and that's, in fact, part of the argument, perhaps in response, is that she should have brought her claim sometime prior to the ending of the statute of limitations to enforce that agreement.
Yes, I understand that. But I think the more critical thing here is the damages question, and that is that the distinct obligation is that in the agreement it doesn't indicate that the damages, the 50%, excuse me, of distribution of proceeds is contingent upon her actually having an interest in the property. And you can't have a cause of action for a claim to distribution of proceeds until the proceeds exist and the distribution doesn't occur. And in this case, that hadn't happened at the time of the commencement of the action, but it has happened since that time. So the statute of limitations would not have accrued on that. It is accruing at the present time, but it hadn't accrued at that time. If at the time of filing the complaint, the appellant had stated a claim for damage specifically for a lack of distribution, it would have been premature because there was not a purchase agreement existing pursuant to which an obligation to distribute would have existed.
But she did have, in April of 2018, a ripe claim to enforce the obligation that she receive half interest in the property.
She had a right to essentially... the obligation, when the obligation would accrue, when it would happen, she would have a right to receive those that distribution, yes. And in the sense that even today, as we sit here today, those funds have not been distributed. They clearly are not intending to distribute them to the plaintiff or to the appellant, which would constitute an anticipatory repudiation. And that would have been in place at the time of the trial. Again, it's the law of the case. So regardless of whether it's in a complaint, which are to be liberally construed, it should have been litigated. It essentially was litigated. And there is no statute of limitations of 6 years that has passed on that claim.
Can I just clarify, Mr. Tillman, would it not be true that in order to be entitled to 50% of the proceeds, one would have to show title to the property of 50%? Doesn't that bring us back to the issue of the statute of limitations and the fact that she doesn't have title?
The agreement included both of those provisions. It included you get 50% of proceeds plus $25,000 is what it says. But it doesn't say that one is contingent upon the other. There's nothing that would prohibit or does prohibit two parties from entering into an agreement that says, you get, when we sell this property, you get this money.
But that's not what this agreement says. Don't we look at the agreement as a whole, which seems to me to be replete with references to the fact that these parties were going to be co-owners of this property? Don't we have to read this agreement as a whole?
That was the intent of the parties, that all of that would occur.
And when it didn't the breach occur right then, when that did not occur on September 29th, 2000?
Well, it's on September 29th, 2000, if the breach occurred, if they walked out of the closing. They weren't supposed to do it at the closing. How are they going to do it at the closing as a practical matter? I mean, she's not taking title.
All right. Assuming you're, I agree with you that maybe she didn't have a breach of contract claim on that particular day. But 2 months later, if there hadn't been a transfer of the property, which we know there wasn't, what would have prevented your client from starting a lawsuit in December of 20?
Nothing would have prohibited her from doing it at that time. But the obligation, again, to pay the 50% of proceeds wouldn't have occurred at that time regardless. It wouldn't have occurred. The way the district court reasons this is essentially a contract would have come into existence upon performance, and performance being the deeding of the 50% interest by the respondent. Well, the problem with that is if that's all you need for performance, then there cannot be a breach. Because there you have the fulfillment of the obligation, now we're done. But a second thing comes into play, which is when the property is sold, then you get the proceeds. So here we have a situation where, okay, let's say a statute of limitations of 6 years applies to the transfer of the property, and that begins to occur on September 29th of 2000. Does that mean then that you would not have a claim on the distribution of proceeds after the 6 years have passed? No.
Well, if there had been a finding that there was no valid contract, I mean, if the breach of contract claim had been brought and a determination made that there was no valid contract, then yes, that would have an impact on the proceeds from sales, wouldn't it?
Well, the point I'm making is that assuming that the property had been deeded, then under the district court's reasoning, then we're done. There's nothing more. And you've got 6 years that passed. So if you have six, so
you're talking about the district court's analysis on the enforceability or the existence of a valid contract.
Correct. And the point I'm trying to make is that obviously there's two separate and distinct obligations, because if you say the obligation accrued on September 29th of 2000 and your 6 years passes, okay. But if the interest had been conveyed, then there's no cause of action on that issue, because that has happened. So there is no six-year issue. But now we have another thing, and the other thing being the obligation to pay the proceeds. And so there is no statute of limitations running on that at that point in time, and that does not begin to accrue. Because of that, there are clearly two separate obligations, one not necessarily dependent upon the other.
Is there in support of that argument that you're making, is there evidence in the record, is there testimony to supplement, you know, the four corners of the document that you're relying on when making that argument? Or are you making that argument based solely on the face of the complaint, of the contract?
Could you repeat? I'm not clear.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering, in support of that argument, that there's two independent obligations and that the latter is not dependent on the former, are you relying solely on, are we simply looking at the four corners of the document, or are you relying on what we might consider parole evidence that supports that interpretation?
I don't believe there's anything in the record, any testimony as such. I think it's a legal question. As to whether or not the document would be interpreted that way, whether two separate obligations. So I don't think there's any evidence in the record that the parties, of the parties' intent in that regard. Clearly, the parties intended that she receive 50% of the distribution, but the mere fact that they didn't do it doesn't mean that there wasn't an expectation that she wouldn't be entitled to the proceeds. So I guess I'd be relying on parole. Yes.
Well, what is that testimony specifically?
Where is that? I don't believe there is any specific testimony in the record.
For example, there's no testimony by your client about conversations with her mother and stepfather about either before or after the agreement about how it would work?
Correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
Can I ask you about the standing issue?
Yes.
Do you agree that your client did not seek to exempt any interest she might have had in this property from her bankruptcy estate?
There's absolutely nothing disclosed in the bankruptcy petition about the property, about any interest in the property. That's correct.
So then why would she have any standing, any legal interest in that property post-bankruptcy to be asserting in this lawsuit?
Because the parties intended it to be homestead. They treated it that way. They made mortgage payments. She made deductions on her tax returns for a home mortgage interest. It was homestead. When you file a petition in bankruptcy, if it is homestead, it is exempt.
Well, you have to claim it as an exemption, don't you? I mean, I don't think it's automatic under the bankruptcy law, is it?
The fact that she didn't do it, didn't claim it, didn't say anything about it, that's correct. But if she had claimed it, it's a moot question, because if she had, it's a moot issue, if she had filed it and claimed it, it would have been exempt. Therefore, if you go back and correct the mistake, the trustee in bankruptcy would not have had any interest in the property. And therefore, you know, how can you say then at this point that she has no standing because the property belonged to the trustee? It never would have. It never would have belonged to the trustee.
Schedule G says, describe all executory contracts of any nature, and so on. Would you agree that this contract, the way you see it, would be an executory contract?
You're not talking about, you're talking about the agreement itself that we're talking about.
Well, I'm thinking about paragraph four, which taken by itself, and I understand there's an issue about whether it's conditioned on paragraph one, but paragraph four indicates that at some future point in time, she might have a right to proceeds. So would that make this an executory contract? And I guess my follow-up question is, if it had been disclosed, I'm curious how that would have been treated in bankruptcy. I know that's kind of outside the briefing, but I'm just wondering if
unfortunately, Your Honor, I need to concede that I do believe it is an executory contract and probably should have been disclosed in the petition.
And if it had been disclosed, do you have any insight into how that would have been treated in the bankruptcy process?
My insight and my experience in bankruptcy essentially is that the trustee would have taken a look at it and then made a determination about whether or not the trustee wanted to assert any kind of an interest. in the proceeds, in the potential proceeds, and if not, then abandon it, and then it would have not been an issue. But it's pure speculation to, at this point, to say how the trustee would have handled that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Council, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Council for respondent?
May it please the court and council, my name is Daniel Gallatin. I am counsel for Mr. Albert Brandmeier. Ms. Terry Johnson, the then power of attorney, is in the courtroom, and I wish to just to acknowledge her presence here. Generally, when I look at a case, what I look at is, where do you start with factually, and then where do you end up based upon those facts? Today with you, though, I wish to take a slightly different approach and something that actually may be of value for the folks in the audience. At the end of the day, on this sort of a case, what I think about is this. For us as lawyers and the law, is it not the situation that we are to use the law and our skills and such to end up in a proper result? That's what we, I think, ultimately should be using the law for and our positions for. With that end point in mind, I then go back and look at some things with this case. September 29 of 2000, there is an alleged agreement whereby Andrea Talman has an obligation to provide, amongst other things, $25,000. In exchange for that $25,000, she then will take upon some rights and obligations theoretically going forward. Where's the $25,000? We know where it is, and more importantly, we know where it never was. It was never Andrea Talman's. It is evidenced in the record and provided for the court that $25,000 was a gift from Ursula Brandmeier's parents to Albert and Ursula Brandmeier. There was never anything given from Andrea Talman for $25,000 to support her end of this purported bargain.
Why then did the party sign an agreement saying that she would be credited in the amount of $25,000?
I wasn't there, and we don't have any evidence on the record that explains what the parties' thought process actually was at the point when whoever drafted it and put it in there. What we do know, though, is that there is an obligation, according to the terms of the agreement, that $25,000 in some way, shape, or form passed through Andrea Talman under her rights of ownership or something or another in order for her to have a credit. And what we also know from the record is $25,000 never passed through her.
Well, I think what this record suggests is this is a family kind of deal, and things didn't play out necessarily as they are referenced on the document. But, you know, where does that leave your argument in terms of the overall result? Are you suggesting the district court correctly said there never was an enforceable agreement? Is that the focus of your defense?
That, plus if we look at what the district court also concluded is that there's an unenforceability to the contract, even if you suppose it exists. There's an unenforceability based upon, amongst other things, some of the equities and the doctrine of unclean hands, which I think resoundingly defeats any concept that Andrea Talman should have any rights to anything coming out of this. And if you go back then on the enforceability question first, in the event, in the district court, if I may refer to this briefly, the district court referenced the Bjorkman case, I believe it was, on the actions of the party evidencing acceptance of the terms. The terms of the September 29, 2000 purported agreement identifies several obligations that the parties have, including number one, transfer interest upon signing. And as a brief side note, upon, I think very clearly, is when it happens. That is the temporal element that directly dovetails from upon. That said, upon the signing, there's to be a conveyance to incorporate Andrea Talman onto title to the property. And this timing is essentially contemporaneous. Signed September 29, closed September 29, onto title September 29. It doesn't happen.
So is that a breach or a failure of a condition precedent in your mind?
That is, as evidenced through the district court, and what I agree with is, evidence by action of a rejection of the terms of the deal itself.
And why that as opposed to simply a breach of that mutual agreement?
Well, according to District Court Judge Bethany Fountain Lindberg, through her analysis of the evidence presented, that by the course of the actions of the parties through that, through the bankruptcy petition, through the failure to make payments, et cetera, the evidence by the action of the parties was a rejection of the agreement itself such that it hadn't actually been formed. And the standard that we look at here for today is whether she, as the trial court judge, pardon me if I don't state it exactly correct, but is there a reasonable basis or the reasonable evidence adduced at trial to support her findings? And I think that quite substantial evidence was introduced at trial that support her finding, that the course of action of the parties rejecting that there had been a contract formed in the first place. With respect to the statute of limitation issue, one that I think is very, very important, what we can identify is a couple of things, both through the briefing then to address the argument of counsel. I believe it's the Herman case that identifies you don't need an exact tabulation of damages in order to have the right and obligation to commence an action.
But if we agree with you that there was no, that the contract had not yet matured because of the failure of the condition precedent, where would the contract claim come from?
I don't think there is a valid contract claim.
Right, so there wouldn't have been, I'm trying to square the statute of limitations decision of the district court with the district court's findings with respect to the existence of an enforceable valid contract.
What I believe in the way that I read the district court's order on it is sort of a covering all the what ifs. I mean, she uses, for example, even if there was an enforceable contract, that is in I think paragraph 14 or so. What the district court judge says is even if there was an enforceable contract, it is doubtful that it would be valid, something of that nature is her language. The way that I read the district court's order is sort of a tiering. First and foremost, we don't have an enforceable contract. But for the sake of covering our basis on an argument basis, if there was an enforceable contract, then statute of limitations precludes enforcement. And then a second, even if we don't address a statute of limitations issue, and even if we have an enforceable contract, we have a lack of standing through the bankruptcy proceeding. That is how I mesh the district court's order. I think it's a covering of all the bases.
Mr. Gallatin, let's focus on that middle what if. Let's presume for a moment a valid contract. Would you respond to Mr. Flynn's point? And as I'm looking at the contract, presuming it's a contract, but I understand your argument. Can you comment on the distinction he makes from title and the statute of limitations of transferring? And I think I understood that he would concede, I believe, that that is the September 29th date. However, when you look at the document, and the last paragraph does clearly indicate that upon sale, 50% of the money, and hence that would be a separate provision, and that's upon the sale, which would be obviously a later date, and therefore within, the complaint would be within the statute of limitations. Do you disagree with that analysis, and if so, why? And again, we're presuming a valid contract.
I do disagree, and this is why. As I'm sitting here and thinking about the litigations that I have on contract cases, to some small extent, I hope you go with that argument, because we can identify, well, look, we're going to sit back and let's not enforce, for example, on here, paragraph, maybe it's 2, depending on how you read it. Let's not enforce paragraph 2. And what we're going to do is we're going to permit and disregard the Minnesota law that says you have to bring your claim in part so that the other parties, the adversary, knows you have a claim that you think exists. So let's say, okay, paragraph 2, we're going to not abide by our statute of limitations of paragraph 2. And what we're going to do is we're just going to reserve all of our other claims under, and this is where I think is the important part, it's one contract. What we're being asked to accept here under their premise is we are permitted to fracture one contract into several different areas that can be litigated at any given point in time. And that's not the law. We have one document that in and of itself creates a cause of action as of September the 29th of 2000. I've not seen any authority that identifies you can waive enforceability of a contract upon the commencement of a cause of action and just sort of preserve the contract itself for a later date if you think something else is done wrong. And that's the argument that has to be accepted, and that I don't believe exists as a point of law for Minnesota. And I think it's actually apparent because when the law was applied on through 541 point, I think it's 02 and 05, and then you also apply the Herman case, the Rule 12 standard is extraordinarily minimal. Once a cause of action accrues, the contract becomes at issue for statute of limitations purposes.
You asserted a counterclaim and brought it to trial, right?
Correct.
Which paragraph was the counterclaim based on?
I don't think it was based on any paragraph of the complaint. And in fact, the counterclaim was premised upon the invalidity or lack of merit of the complaint, the counterclaim being based on the non-payment of rent. And that being based upon the position of, you're not an owner. I mean, fine, and I think at the time.
So where was her obligation to pay rent specified?
Well, not through there was not any writing that we were aware of anywhere between Albert Brandmeier and Andrea Talman that evidenced what you would generally see in a standard landlord-tenant relationship. I think probably Your Honor is correct in that this was a bit more of a familial situation, that they didn't reduce the terms of the tenancy to a writing. That said, and perhaps a significant portion of why that claim lost at trial, is we didn't have a writing to evidence why is it that she owes rent. But how we'd arrive at the situation of rent owed is you're living in one half of the property. You don't get to live for free. You owe some monies for occupying the residency, that being in the form of rents. And I guess now, Your Honor, what I can also address is that the premise of there being rents owed is also derived from the bankruptcy petition of Albert and Ursula Brandmeier. In that bankruptcy petition, they listed on a number of occasions the rental income that they were receiving. The incorporation of that rental income being significant because that would be an asset and an income that would have to be taken into consideration on, as I understand it, the dischargeability of their debts and their ability to pay sort of things. So when they report in 2010, Andrea Talman is paying us rent, we have rental income. We have no reason to believe that has changed over the course of time. She continues to reside there, hence the rent claim.
Well, and that dovetails with the obligation in the contract to make that Ms. Talman was to make monthly principal and interest payments of, which you characterize as rent, but under the agreement it would be payment as her half of ownership.
Well, I would offer that there's a material difference between rental payment and principal and interest payments.
I acknowledge that. I'm just saying that as the case was presented, and you didn't file a notice of related appeal on the counterclaim.
No, Your Honor. At some point there are economic practicalities that become involved.
Mr. Gallatin, you've referenced in your brief and argued it again today, the defense of unclean hands. Would you agree that since that's an equitable defense, that would only be relevant to the equitable claims in the complaint, but not the legal claims such as a breach of contract?
I don't know, Your Honor, to be honest, that that would be the case, in that you could parcel out a defense, whether it's equitable or a defense at law, to be contingent upon or dependent upon the nature of the claims presented. I don't know that that's actually the case.
So your point being is you believe it's relevant to all the claims?
Yes. A defense to claims is a defense to claims. Whether the defense is an equitable one or a legal one, it remains a defense to claims, whether the claims be at law or on an equitable basis. Because I think you can have an affirmative defense on an equitable basis to at-law claims. That actually, I think, is a certainty. Now, I could research it. I don't know that I didn't address it in that manner, but that is my position on that. So with just a bit of time remaining, for many, many a reason, the end point on this case, the end result, was arrived at with respect to the issues at appeal. There is either a fraud upon the United States District Court in bankruptcy on the denial of any ownership interest, of any rights to $25,000, of any rights to equity, or there was perjury in district court by saying, I have rights to ownership. The law of the state identifies you don't get to sit on your contract until you think it's a better time to present a claim or to present a claim that you think is different. With that, I apologize if I ran a bit over. I didn't see that. My time is up, and I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Fling, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points in response. First of all, with respect to the consideration issue, which was being raised about the $25,000 gift amount being credited to the appellant, I think the point on consideration here is simply that you can either have a benefit conferred or a detriment. Then you have that. Then you have consideration. In this case, the district court chose to look only at the appellant's part of it and say she didn't suffer a detriment because this was a gift that came from the grandfather. She didn't look at the fact that the respondent, in fact, received a benefit. The law doesn't provide that that benefit necessarily has to come from the other party. It can come from a third party. So the fact that it was a gift is pretty, quite frankly, irrelevant to the question of whether consideration existed. Mr. Brandmeier got $25,000. There was an obligation then on his part to convey, which he did not. And that also then relates to the question about whether or not there was a breach or a condition precedent that did not occur. It's interesting if you look at it from the district court standpoint, she is saying, well, acceptance would occur upon performance of the act, as opposed to the other way around, where acceptance would be the payment of the $25,000. And you have a different result depending on which way you look at it. If you look at it from the district court's point of view, there's no way that a cause of action would ever accrue on an obligation to convey, because if the conveyance occurs, there's no breach. On the other hand, if the conveyance doesn't occur, you never have a contract, therefore there can't be a breach. On the other hand, if you look at it the other way and the obligation to convey, the acceptance is the payment of the $25,000, now the obligation comes into play, you have the condition precedent. You have the breach by the fact that it didn't occur. On one hand, you have a contractual obligation in which an obligation can be enforced and there is a potential cause of action. On the other, you can never have a cause of action. Then on the question of the statute of limitations and the separate causes of action that we're arguing, I would ask the question of how can a cause of action accrue when there has been no breach? And again, we go back to the situation in which if your 6 years run on the obligation to convey and you have to assert your cause of action within that time period, how can it be that you would have to assert a cause of action in that time period for non-payment of proceeds when that had not occurred?
Well, but that's a measure of damages, is it not, as opposed to whether there had been a breach of the contractual obligation overall?
It's a measure of damages, but on the one hand, I'm bringing an action, let's say 3 years in, 3 years after September 29, 2000. I decide, okay, I want that. They're not conveying it. I want my interest. I bring an action for specific performance within the 6 years. But when I do that, there hasn't been a sale.
But presumably you'd get a court ruling, and you get a ruling that says, yes, your client is a 50% owner, and get the thing transferred, then you wouldn't be in the situation at sale time, would you?
Yes, you'd get that. Well,
if you're then get deeded, if you win your contract claim based on the failure to convey, and so you then receive a quitclaim deed for 50% of the proceeds, then you're not going to run into the problem, will you?
Presumably not, because now you have an interest that is of record in the property, and they're not going to be able to convey without your signature. But the point is that the right to bring the claim doesn't accrue until the breach occurs, and the breach on payment doesn't occur until the dollars are there to make the payment. So you have two separate causes of action. And the only way that your statute of limitations runs on the obligation to distribute proceeds is if you make the decision that that obligation is actually contingent upon having a 50% interest in the property. Otherwise, it's a separate cause of action. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. The next case on our calendar for oral argument.